Hello and welcome to Contemplations, and today I'm going to be talking about just how dystopian is China, because there's lots of talk about China. Lots of people talk about how it is hell on earth, and I want to actually look at the evidence and weigh it up, because I've done a fair amount of work on China, both in terms of, you know, some of their traditions and history, as well as modern China and the state in which it's in. And I think that there are elements of it that are over-exaggerated. However, it's still very important to talk about China because it is a sort of testing place. It's a form of pilot study for the dystopian application of technology in the West. And we do see that quite often, whereby the Chinese will do something, the Western leaders will see that it works, and then it will be a sort of means of knowing in advance what technology is going to be introduced here to control us in certain ways. And it is also worth mentioning as well, all the way back in Contemplations 81, I have discussed China's incoming economic crisis. And I'm just going to give you a bit of a refresh about this, because it's not necessarily the focus of this Contemplations, but it's still kind of important to have some of the details. So that's more about how they've poorly structured their economy. They've got lots of bad things going on, like they spend far too much money, and they've actually had to leverage lots of their assets to borrow more money. And now that they can't actually continue to borrow at that rate, they're in a bit of problem of funding local governments, and they might have to restructure their entire economy and how it operates, which for a centralized government, that's very, very important, and it could go seriously wrong. And it might happen at a time whereby they fall into the middle income trap, where they're not able to catch up with the richest countries, and so they'll always be a little bit lower, but they won't be sort of low enough income that they can keep up the rapid growth. But there are lots of unfortunate situations that are coming out from this. And, you know, when people are desperate in a developing economy, it means that there are lots more social problems. And so a lot of these actions seem to be sticking plasters on problems of economic mismanagement, as I see it. And I think that this is the sort of grounding for which a lot of this other stuff follows. But it is worth mentioning as well that I'm going to treat this sort of like a very long podcast segment. I'm going to go through lots of links, lots of news stories, and of course, it's worth bearing in mind that a lot of things that come out of China, both official statistics, news stories, mainstream media stories, have to be taken with a pinch of salt, because of course, the information control of the Chinese Communist Party warps things in ways that are somewhat unpredictable. And it is worth mentioning as well that because the Chinese, at the very least, are not strict globalists in the Western sense, the same people that are trying to screw us over in our own countries actually dislike China as well. That's part of the reason that they're so strict on it, and why they're trying to pressure the Chinese into invading Taiwan so that there can be sanctions put against them and the likes, because they're an outlet of 1.4 billion people that aren't subject to the same form of globalism that our Western elites are trying to push, because of course they've got a, dare I say, a more traditional form of globalism in the form of communism. And even then, they're not as internationalist as, say, the Soviet Union, where they're trying to, say, take over Europe or something like that. Although they're doing a pretty good job in infiltrating our institutions and stealing our secrets and perhaps buying up shares and things like our infrastructure. For example, the Chinese own a fair amount of our water supply in Britain. So there are points of concern here. However, they're so dependent on foreign trade that if that were to stop, the Chinese economy would utterly collapse. And so that, I think, is a strong enough incentive for them to at least not push their luck too much for the time being until circumstances change. But back onto China itself and its domestic situation. And there are two concepts that underlie a lot of what I'm going to talk about next. And it's the sort of premise for how the Chinese state manages its citizens. And the first of which is the Dang'an, which is a pretty easy one to pronounce correctly, actually, meaning archived record or file. really. And this records the performance and attitudes of citizens and is perhaps the most dystopian one of the Chinese state records. And this is going to inform a lot of the things I talk about subsequently. You don't need to necessarily remember the term or how it applies. Simply that this is how their information on citizens flows. This file is the one whereby if someone is, say, a very much pro-liberty or pro-democracy believer, then it'll be on their file here. And also it'll have economic records and things like that. But another important one, particularly in the economy, is that of the hukou. And that, in a literal sense, is translated to household individual. And the word ko means mouth. So it's equivalent to the Western phrase per head, but instead it's per mouth, which I think is actually quite a Chinese way of looking at it. But this has been around since ancient times, and it has been basically been a means of keeping track of who lives where and who owes what in taxes and things like that. And, you know, this isn't necessarily at this point of its scope that dystopian, but the dystopian part here of this system is that which hukou you belong to dictates your access to various public services. So those within an urban hukou, and there's two distinctions, the urban and rural, have better access to things like education, healthcare, and welfare. And people in China are well aware of this distinction. And so that's why there has been probably the largest urban migration in any civilization's history in China, which of course comes with its own problems. It's part of the reason why Chinese urban areas look so ridiculously overpopulated. And of course, it is a largely populated country, but it's also a very big country with some areas that aren't populated at all. And this is why the housing crisis is actually far, far worse than in the West, because in China, you get these crumbling properties, you know, they're really poorly built. You can see new build properties where you can break the concrete with your bare hands without even using full force. And they also pay a significant amount more for these properties as a sort of real terms total of their earnings than you would in even, say, New York or London. And those prices are normally seen by people either in America or Britain as being the sort of pinnacle of expense relative to wages. And yet the Chinese in many urban areas have to pay 2, 3, 4 times more than that. And of course, they're not as wealthy as us as well. And they're less likely to have things like inherited wealth. And therefore, it's even more difficult. And particularly if they've went from a poor rural area to a rich urban area, there is going to be this massive mismatch in how their ability to afford things. And so this is creating a rather unfortunate situation of lots and lots of desperate people. And I've seen videos shared online of streets in China where in every single doorway there's a young woman. And I think that speaks of a certain financial desperation that entire streets have turned to what amounts to prostitution, and it's seemingly a bit more socially acceptable in China than elsewhere, that they're turning to this rather than conventional work because the cost of living is so high and sometimes finding work is difficult. Certainly no excuse for doing so, but when there is an increase in this sort of thing, it is an indicator that there are problems elsewhere. So I think the first thing to look at, and the thing that most people are concerned about, is the social credit system in China. And this was first implemented in 2002 to mirror Western credit scores. So if you're in America, you might get something like a FICO score. To, you know, a British person, we might just call it a credit score. But people generally know what this is, what it means, and they understand that it's necessary because, of course, it tracks your ability to repay loans that you've taken out. And in the modern day and age, you know, it's very rare for people to be able to buy things like property outright with cash. And so we see it as a necessary evil to borrow money to buy our own property because property is expensive. And of course, with the situation in modern day China, with property being so expensive, you need to have a good system of financial loans in place, because otherwise you'll never be able to own a home. And of course, if you're a communist country and everyone's living in rent slavery, it kind of looks a bit bad, although it's also pretty bad that you have ownership of private property in the first place. But yeah, hypocrisy of the CCP aside, I think those sorts of comparisons aren't necessarily that insightful. So in rural China, there were problems with things like small businesses and individuals not having the documents required for financial assessment. So this is the sort of rationale. Whether it's legitimate or not is difficult to tell, because I don't have the full information available, because of course China's not transparent, but it seems like a reasonable thing to say. This does happen in lots of developing countries as well, where they simply don't have the documentation to engage in things that we might take for granted in the West. So, you know, like getting a house, being able to borrow money, you need certain amounts of documents to prove who you are, that you have the income that you do, all of those sorts of things that most people watching this will be well acquainted with, because it's pretty commonplace in the West. But this problem of not having the correct documents led to lots of dodgy dealings, and including sort of business practices, as well as individuals committing things like fraud and gaming the system. And this tends to be pretty undesirable no matter what political system you're in, right? And particularly in a low trust society like China, which we'll be talking about later, the low trust aspect, that is, it's catastrophic, because if everyone is at each other's throats, you can't have social cohesion, you can't run a society, your days are numbered ruling the country. So generally speaking, this social credit system term is just an umbrella term for a host of different things, really. The most common one is applied to individuals, and this is the one that gets the most attention from the West. We don't really talk about the business social credit score, but we talk about the individual one, which is fine. And I think that I'm going to focus mainly on the individual one as well, because of course that's probably most people's point of concern, because we're not so concerned about how governments regulate business, even though that's very important. We're concerned about how businesses regulate us, because it's more directly relevant to our lives, which is fair enough. So more or less, a social credit score for an individual represents their credit history, but is a proxy for their trustworthiness. So in a Western country, your credit score is a proxy for your financial responsibility, really, I think it's fair to say. You know, if you've defaulted on payments of loans, it makes it harder for you to get a loan. And if you're applying for a mortgage, say, they'll look at your credit score as an indicator for your ability to pay, as a proxy for your character. Because of course, it's difficult to tell whether people are honest and whether people will pay you and people will fulfill their end of the bargain. And so making it a mathematical thing that is built up over a lifetime does make sense. I'm not necessarily against the notion of credit scores. They can be done entirely fairly. And I think that in general, better information and making more informed economic decisions is a good thing for everyone. However, I think the key thing in China is that it's a proxy for trustworthiness in a country that trust is incredibly low. And one of the things that we talk about at Lotus Eaters quite a lot is how lots of European countries and North America as well, you know, mainly of European origin, we refer to these as high trust societies. You know, the societies where you can leave your door open and your next door neighbor will come and shut it for you so you don't get stolen from. If you leave something unattended, someone will return it to you. If you pass someone on the street, you say hello and you don't clutch your bag fearing that they're going to steal from you. This used to be the norm, is becoming less so, but it's still an element of our culture. Even, you know, leftist British people still have this high trust element about them sometimes. It depends whether they're in, you know, places, major cities or not. Like if you're in London, it's almost becoming a low trust society now, similar to that of, say, China or many of the third world countries in which its residents come from. But the Chinese people expect people who are strangers to them to lie to them, to try and cheat them. And They also expect to be blamed by both their peers and the state for things that they have not done. And this is just a holdover from the Cultural Revolution, whereby, of course, millions of people died because friends and family turned against one another and things like that, because of the pressure from the communists to find people who were anti-communist. And it, of course, it turned into a form of witch hunt, which and it also served to settle old grudges. And, you know, this is the same in the Soviet Union as well, when peasants were jealous of one farmer who had more farmland than they did, and they didn't see it as fair, which, you know, everyone starts unequally in life. They would just lie to the state and get them to sort them out so they could take their land and gain from it. So when you create a system whereby there's an incentive to sell out your brethren, if you will, or your neighbours, your peers, some people will do so. And through knowing that this happens, as the Chinese people do, they're well aware that this was a period of Chinese history. It's impossible to hide. You become more cautious of other people more generally. And you presume that if they're involved with you in some way, unsolicited, that they must be trying to get something out of you, because it's not for the pleasantry of your company. And of course, this destroys a society. It destroys social cohesion. It destroys trust. And it makes a place unpleasant just to live in. And that, in my opinion, is dystopian all on its own. I mean, I grew up in a place where you say hello to people on the street, people have an honesty box at the end of their driveway with fruit and veg that they've grown. And, you know, it's basically the Garden of England, right? It's a lovely place. But it's not like that in China. People don't have honesty systems. That I think it also flourishes in rural areas, and particularly because of urbanization. The anonymity of a city helps hide criminality, and it's just a function of urban density that is unavoidable. But there is also an application of social credit scores that applies to businesses as well, and this is mainly to determine whether they violated certain standards, for example things like food safety standards. And there is a good example of this, actually. In 2009 there was a huge scandal in China, in which actually two people were executed for tainted milk. And this was quite egregious because there wasn't the nutrient density they required to be able to sell it. And so they added in, the actual chemical. They added some sort of chemical into the formula, the infant formula, which resulted in 6 children dying and 300,000 infants being ill. So you understand why they killed them. I think that's actually probably the right thing to do there. I mean, you murdered 6 children to make money, as well as making 300,000 of them ill. And I think it was some sort of heavy metal in there. Where is it? I did have it in the article somewhere. But nevertheless, what they had in there isn't important. The important thing is that these sorts of things where companies were cutting corners to make money was going on. And I know that happens in the West, but it was even worse in China at the time. And so it made sense for them to introduce some sort of way of gauging the reliability of the company. In, you know, the Western world, generally you have lots of different private rating agencies that determine how good a company is, more or less. You know, you've got things like Trustpilot, you've got Which in the UK, I think. But you've got websites that basically review different companies and how pro-consumer their services are. And they go through with a fine-tooth comb and try and spot who the bad actors are. Of course, we also have government agencies and lots of regulations determining the conduct of these businesses, which China certainly did have. But of course, it's such a large country that inevitably things are going to slip through the cracks because of the scale of what they have to do, and particularly because of how authoritarian and I suppose you could say, what can you refer it to? All-encompassing the governance is in China. So the social credit system also doesn't apply across China evenly. It's actually divided up into different provinces, and each province manages the social credit system slightly differently. There was a push, of course, from the central government, the CCP, but the provincial governors were actually charged with executing this. And this style of governance has been around in China since ancient times, where you have a sort of emperor figure ruling the entire nation, but the provinces are sort of their own dominions that answer to the emperor. You know, Emperor Xi, or Winnie the Pooh, whatever you want to call him. And of course, you can see here the development of the social credit system is marked by lots of regional differences, as the title says. And the lighter yellow color indicates fewer documents, the darker sort of red color indicates more documents, and it's between 0 and about 40. That's how many documents vary in Sichuan, Jiangsu, Shanghai, and I'm really butchering these. Zhejiang are some of the provinces that have the most, and Xinjiang, Tibet, and Liaoning are some of the provinces that have the least, as well as Henan and Hunan. I'm probably getting those wrong as well, but close enough. And so I find it interesting, actually, that some of the provinces that are the most unruly, you know, Xinjiang and Tibet, there's lots of questions. You know, you got the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, who are, we'll be getting onto them later. And of course, you've got Tibet, who it could be argued may not even belong in China. And of course, there's a separatist movement there that's heavily suppressed and they're heavily surveilled. And so you'd think that if this were an instrument of repression, that those provinces would have the largest amount of requirement to actually get it going. And I'm not, you know, carrying water for the CCP. I think they're horrible people and all of that. And I also think that the social credit system is very dystopian. But the way it's been communicated as this is the way of the CCP controlling people isn't quite right. It is a means of controlling people, but not as directly as people argue. And I think the devil here is in the details, because as I said at the start of this, China is the sort of canary in the coal mine for how technology is going to be used dystopianly, if that's a word, in the West. And so having an accurate understanding of what's going on in China is important. And I'll be getting on to why it's particularly insidious later. Of course, there are things about it that are insidious, but it's been exaggerated to a certain extent, I suppose, is the point I'm trying to make. But let's get on to the nuts and bolts of what it actually does. So here are some things that demote the score. Having a court order to repay owed money is the main thing. And it's worth mentioning as well, if it gets to the point where you're in court for owing someone money, that's quite an extreme scenario. That's true of anywhere in the world, really. Normally, when people borrow money, they're able to repay it until they've paid off the loan. If you have to go to court, that's normally unusual, not unheard of course, but is a reasonable thing to be concerned about, I suppose. And in the sort of provincial sense, these vary depending on which province you're in. I would imagine the ones that demand more documents will, generally speaking, also have more criteria to mark down your social credit score. But things like drinking and driving, stealing, smoking in a non-smoking zone, buying too many video games, although I wasn't necessarily able to verify that one, posting fake news online, and that is specifically relating to terrorist attacks and airport security. So it's not necessarily about everything, because of course, in a country of 1.4 million people, if you were concerned about everything that wasn't true online, it would be a bit of a headache to enforce that. But I think that they're mainly concerned about things that might damage the CCP. And so anything that might suggest that they're not doing a good job at protecting against terrorism or, you know, airport security, which I think is probably related to terrorism, then that might be a particularly strong black mark against your name in China. And also other ones are playing video games for too long. which I am very much against. That's enough to be against the social credit system alone, in my opinion. Wasting money on frivolous purchases, again, that's a very dystopian thing. Who determines what is frivolous, what is necessary? And posting on social media, which although I still think is dystopian, I kind of think it's funny at the same time. If you punish people for posting on social media in the West, my goodness, would we have a better society? But I don't agree with punishing people for doing that thing anyway and being silly. So here's another story that's been doing the rounds. This is from 2019. In China, you get a special warning before you call people who owe money, telling you to get them to pay up. And these people are known as laolai, or judgment defaulter. And this is specifically referring to someone as being untrustworthy. And of course, this is very important in China because low trust, they're aware that it's low trust. And therefore, to be labeled low trust carries quite a high taboo. And you get this by being ordered by a court to pay back money. So it's the sort of more conservative with a small c version of the social credit system here. And I'm reading directly from the article here. Some local phone operators have assigned special ringtones to warn people that they're calling a laolai and ask them to please urge the person to pay back the money. Ringtones have been in place since at least 2017, the year a court in Guanyu County, Eastern China, worked with a local telecom operator to design a ringtone that tells callers. So the point of this, because there is a sort of shaming culture in China, I mentioned earlier about women turning to prostitution because of the state of the economy. If they get caught out for doing something wrong elsewhere, because that's how they enforce the law, it's pretty done out in the open. Party members do it, are involved in that sort of thing. But if you do something wrong or you're too obvious, then they will punish you. Or punish the prostitutes at least, and they'll parade them through a street to try and shame them, you know, with signs or with officials saying that they were caught for doing this. And so that ringtone is meant to operate on a similar sort of basis, that they're going to shame people socially into complying with the state, which is obviously quite scary. And that is quite dystopian, isn't it, really? Although, you know, there's no pleasant way to deal with someone who owes money and they're not paying it back. I mean, sending debt collectors is a pretty scary notion. They're just going to come around and take stuff. And so I can see either way it being a relatively dystopian thing. But another thing that's worth mentioning is that this sort of status, this untouchable individual, this untrustworthy person, only really applies to about 13 million people, at least in about 2019. Maybe it'll be 14, 15 million people by now. Who knows? But it's in that sort of neck of the woods. So if you're taking this 13 million figure from 2019 and dividing that by the population of 1.4 billion, that is only 0.0092%. of the population. So that's sort of the worst of the worst, if you will. Of course, there's probably that would be for the worst offenders, I suppose, the people who get all of the negative effects applied to them. But one would presume that even if you're not one of these 13 million, but you have a low social credit score, there are still things that you might be barred from. I remember writing about, I think on an article on the site, that some people with a low social credit score can't even get an umbrella from a hotel. Of course, because it's a proxy for trustworthiness, the presumption is that you're not going to return that umbrella, so the hotel doesn't want to loan it to you. But even so, if you go to a nice expensive hotel in the West, they're not so concerned about that. And you have a certain amount of freedom. You don't feel like you're constantly being judged for your trustworthiness constantly.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.